Good morning, everyone. I'm Mel.
And I'm Pippa. We're the creators and editors of Earthrights, the podcast and platform that focuses on the connection between human rights and environmental issues.
Just a quick message before we begin. The views and research presented on this podcast are either our own or referenced on our website, www.earthrights.co.uk. We generally always record a few weeks ahead of release, so some facts or situations may have changed during this time.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 8 of the Earthrights podcast. Today we're tackling the second half of last week's episode, the human rights side. At Earthrights, we focus on both human rights and the environment. And last week, we talked about the possibility and opportunities of a green recovery from COVID-19. So today, we're going to be talking about the possibility of an ethical recovery from COVID-19. There's no denying that obviously the past year and the beginning of this year have had a terrifying impact on all of our lives. And I don't think there's a single person that hasn't been affected in some way. Mm. And it would take a lot for us to pick apart every single aspect of the human felt struggle of the pandemic, but we want to look more specifically at what the pandemic has exposed and look at kind of the fragilities and inequalities in our system, and therefore the opportunity that the recovery provides us. So Mel, let's just go back to basics for a bit. What does ethical mean?
Ethics is a branch of moral philosophy and understanding how we live our lives in terms of what we think is right and what we think is wrong. And it can therefore refer to sort of an unspoken social code or a set of principles that each of us govern our lives by. Morals are really important for us to understand all of the circumstances of a situation at a given time and in a given society or culture. For example, the clearly have all had different approaches to the way that we've responded to the pandemic. Mm. And that's okay. But then obviously we are working in a very globalized and international world. And so if we're all not following the same set of principles and moral guidelines, then there's going to be huge disparities and inequalities created, not only at a supranational level, but also very locally. So if we think of ethics as a means of guiding laws and human rights and the reasons behind why they exist. So first part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that we must regard the dignity and worth of the human person without regard to nationality, ethnic or racial identity, or gender or moral status. So it basically means that we're members of the human family. But the problem is that the pandemic and ways certain places have lived their lives has meant that we've kind of lost sight of what it has meant to be members of the human family. And in that sense, we haven't had a very ethical or fair or just way of living our lives. And that's what the pandemic has exposed.
I think fairness is something that's on the tip of everyone's tongues at the moment, even just amongst your own community or your own group of friends. I don't know, I think we all kind of feel very strongly when something isn't fair. And we might just have, people breaking the rules or not following the rules to the same degree, or in the news recently seeing influencers in Dubai, and this kind of sense of is that fair? I think it's something that we're all thinking about more than ever, because I guess the first lockdown, it was a bit more we're all in this together, clap for the NHS, all this kind of thing. But I saw a saying, it's we're all in the same storm, but we're not in the same boat. Because, the situation is so different from person to person, and it's not really fair to judge how someone is reacting. But you also can't compare. Somebody might be a single mum with three kids at home. Someone might live on their own. And those two people might long for the other person's situation. Mm. But they're both equally bad for that individual person. And it's very insular.
Yeah, it's what creates so much anger. And why I think this can actually be a really traumatic and emotionally difficult time to sort of contend with.
Yeah, I think the pandemic has highlighted kind of so many injustices and inequalities, from access to resources, whether that's access to healthcare online teaching, access to computers, access to books. It's highlighted the weaknesses in our state benefits system. Like many people who like need support aren't able to get it. And there's a growth in this group of people called the precariat, making up 6% of the workforce. So this means kind of like self-employed people, people on zero-hour contracts, so people who have like precarious job roles. You know, if you work in a restaurant on a zero-hour contract, so you don't know how much money you're going to make each month. Yeah, this kind of system just like isn't sustainable for so many people. And we also have like mass unemployment, especially kind of in young people. Yeah, this has just only been kind of exacerbated by the pandemic. And we're also facing a mental health crisis. Like alcohol and substance consumption has gone up by over 25% just during the pandemic. Well, a lot of people would say they're drinking more now, you know, because there's just not that distinction between the weekend and
yeah,
it's quite stressful and all these things. So yeah, I think that's definitely really worrying. And like with that, there's kind of, you know, people don't have their usual escapes, like visiting an art gallery or playing sport or going to the gym or meeting a friend, going to the cinema.
With what you're saying about utilizing the things that we would usually have access to like make us feel better, the NHS has started to provide green space as a means to tackle like the mental health crisis. And that's quite a raw subject because a lot of people in the UK don't have access to green space, and generally low income families or ethnic minority communities are ending up not having access to the green space that they might need, or like the get out zones, in order to improve their health.
Yeah, and I think that kind of the fact that the NHS are like prescribing people to kind of get outdoors into green space is like, again, like links back to kind of the principle of the podcast, because it's like this connection between humans and nature. Being outside with nature is so important for our mental health. And it's, yeah, just like unjust that some people just don't have access to any green space, like, you know, anywhere near their house. They might have like a local park, but you know, they can't, if they don't drive and they can't go on public transport, then they can't get out of the city. Also, there's been a rise in domestic abuse, with people, mainly women and children, being like stuck at home during the lockdown and nowhere to go. Like, obviously, tensions are high in every household. The UN even described it as a shadow pandemic.
I think that's really powerful. One really beautiful initiative, I think it was on the news like last year, has started in the West Bank, which is a really small country next to Jordan. And women would bash pots and pans out of their windows to show to other women or children or people that were trying to escape domestic abuse that their house was open for them to come in and relieve themselves of the abuser.
Yeah, I've seen similar things like in the UK. Like I just looked it up now, and it's if you go into Boots, for example, and say you're looking for Annie, or say the acronym Annie, which is A-N-I, and stands for action needed immediately, then like the people, the staff help the person in that situation, because especially in lockdown, like a lot of the services previously available might not be. So yeah, we'll like leave a list of any kind of resources for anyone that is affected or knows anyone affected by any of the topics we're talking about. And obviously, we can't not talk about the racial injustices that we've seen. 2020 saw the Black Lives Matter movements and kind of us all gaining an increasing awareness of ingrained institutional racism sparked by the death of, or the murder of, George Floyd. And there's just been a rising awareness of environmental and social justice movements. And this, like, as we were talking about with things like Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups being less likely to access green space. And being more likely to live in areas of high air pollution. You know, this is all connected to the health crisis. Like, air pollution increases the likelihood of dying from COVID-19, with Black, Asian, ethnic minority groups more likely to be exposed to air pollution. This like partly explains why death rates are higher in these groups of people.
One report that was just like pretty disgusting was when Tory MP Craig Whittaker said that ethnic minority communities, particularly those from Muslim backgrounds, were to blame for the spreading of coronavirus.
I'm a politician.
Say something like that.
And like even, you know, like with ex-president of America calling it the China virus, no doubt we're going to see like a wave of racism towards Chinese people. Mm. I'm sure that that is like occurring now and will continue. And I think it's like, it's just like sad because this should be a time when we're coming together as a global population, but instead it's like these further divisions.
And because of these like systemic failures, people are having to rely a lot more on philanthropy and the charity sector. And like, this is beautiful in the sense that people are giving up their time and obviously trying to help people, but that means that the system isn't helping them or providing enough for them, and isn't reaching a minimum standard. And also, if people aren't being provided with the things they need to live a basic existence, then how can they be more active and participatory on a
And it's degrading, you know, for people that maybe previously never have always been financially secure and like have been able to provide for their families and now suddenly can't, and aren't being able to get resources from the government, so are relying on charity. You know, like you said, it's amazing and beautiful that those resources are there and that people are giving up their time, but it shouldn't be how like a modern society functions, where like, I don't know the stats, but where millions of people are relying on charity for like what we would call basic welfare. And
People who can provide for charity or can take part in voluntary exercises, like that's great, but they already would then need to have a place to live and food to eat in order to give their time up. And not everyone can do that. And so it's great that they are. But yeah, I think it just highlights that some real like rejigging needs to be had.
And again, access to food, this like reliance on the charity sector. And I think, something that's been in like the like focal point of public consciousness is with the school meals, and with Marcus Fratchford, who was advocating for the government to U-turn on its decision to stop the provision of free school meals to some of the most disadvantaged children. And the fact that this required like a footballer or a public figure to kind of make this change happen. And, you know, we're thankful that like the government did U-turn on this, but it's just like, surely the pandemic is not the time to start penalizing the people who are least able to change their situation, like children in disadvantaged communities. And even then, like, it's amazing that the government offered these food packages. But I don't know if you saw, Mel, viral on social media, like the food that these families and children were receiving is just a joke. And it's like a block of cheese and a petit filo or whatever, like a yogurt.
Yeah, I could just feel that that's what you were going to say about that. Oh, I'm so glad it was made viral, because it was just absolutely outrageous how substandard it all was. And just going back to what Marcus Rashford has been advocating for, but the fact that it's not just once that he's had to lobby the government and campaign for free school meals. It's been so many times on like so many different occasions.
Yeah. And like another Tory MP, Kevin Hollenrake, tweeted that it's a parent's job to feed their children, and shows a complete lack of awareness and understanding of the British public and the situation, because I don't think there's a single parent out there who wouldn't want to feed their children. But it's like, you know, this is like a situation where like help is needed, and children of all people shouldn't be penalized or punished for the economic situation that we're in.
Definitely. And I think that also, like, perhaps that tweet that you just quoted sparked a lot of debate around like single parent families and the racist roots of the provision of free school meals. Like at this time of crisis, we need to be providing school meals to all groups in society that have been disproportionately affected by discriminatory social policies. The Guardian reported a lot about this. It looked back into the history of when school meals were first provided. And so in 1906, the Provision of School Meals Act was passed. But it was passed on the basis that British troops in the Boer War, young white male troops, were underperforming, essentially, and it was attributed to their physical deterioration. And the government at the time couldn't believe that what they were considering to be the apex of our imperial system. So the young white male, like, supposed to be culturally and physically superior, like this is quoted from the article, were actually weak and underperforming. So their solution to that was to provide for school meals. So Marcus Rashford and his school meal campaign was only asking for a very reasonable expansion to that act.
Definitely. And we'll be kind of looking at the food system in more detail later in the year when the UN Secretary General has called for a food summit for the first time in over a decade, which is really interesting. And to coincide with this, we'll be hosting a mini series looking at food systems.
One way we can think about this sort of ethical recovery is that many people and businesses have lost sight of what we think of as moral and ethical, and what is like a minimum standard.
Yeah, I just think it's quite interesting. Businesses have lost sight of like the moral and ethical minimum. And like I was reading somewhere that they were kind of saying like, it's actually crazy that in terms of fashion, which we discuss in episode 2 of the podcast, that there is such thing as a sustainable and ethical fashion. Like, it's kind of crazy that the rest of fashion exists otherwise. You know, it's just like, how have we reached a point where behaving in an ethical way is something that's commended rather than just the minimum you're expected to do? You know, it's like, we've got to like a very dark place with this like growth, and we're just like disregarding humans and the planet in a way that's, yeah, just disgusting.
Completely inhumane, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important to reassert that dignity and respect must be given to all humans without discrimination. And this does mean that the human rights movement shouldn't be appropriated. I've been thinking about this a lot recently. But the way that certain people have ended up trying to use human rights as a discourse to get away with things, or to put other people's lives in danger, or have kind of missed the point. So, for example, in the US, when activists were protesting for the right to become infected, and I mean, there's been numerous examples of this sort of thing, but that's just highlighting that the system is in peril at the moment.
Yeah. So, like, instead of, you know, just ignoring it, we can grow and learn from the experience through accountability and an acknowledgement for what has been going on.
Like you were just saying, with the losing sight of that sort of ethical standard for businesses, like that is one way that businesses can start putting humans and ethical policy back at the center of their practices. So if they're acknowledging things and they're held accountable to abuses or injustices, then they'll start actually behaving in a way that's right. And I think that's a really important for the general rebalancing of our social order, because in terms of something like the globalized businesses, they aren't an elected government, no matter how we like want to criticize our own system of government or whatever. But we haven't asked for Jeff Bezos to be able to control entire electoral systems in states, but he can, because Amazon is so, like, has so much power. And so, like, actually, if they had the impact on humans at the center of their business practices, then perhaps they wouldn't do like damaging things. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think like having that sense of acknowledgement is key, because as like the consumer or the individual, it can be like quite hard to find out the truth of a business's supply chain or how they like pay their employees, like all of their kind of ethical practices. But it's just like that there's just currently a lack of knowledge, and I think, yeah, that definitely needs to change, because as you say, like, we've reached a point where businesses are more powerful than governments. And we're able to hold governments account to account through like freedom of information requests or debates, question times, things like that. But yet we can't hold companies to account in the same way because the information doesn't legally have to be in the public domain.
Yeah, you're so right. And I guess thinking about this sort of structural element of our society, like having businesses at the top and money at the top of the priorities, and also tech and science. So the government's publication on its plan to rebuild. And one of the things that it said on it was, before the virus struck, the government's budget set out plans to invest in infrastructure, science and tech. And in my head, I was like, well, great, but there's a million and other parts of our society that also need investment in. And then it did go on to say, like, luckily it had realized that that was maybe not the best move, and said, now it is the government's responsibility to build the public health and rebuild the governmental infrastructure. And I liked that because it was finally remembering that there's other parts of the system that need a bit of a recalibration, not just keeping on developing new technology and whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Like rather than just having more and more when like our existing infrastructure is kind of in a crisis, like, as we've seen, you know, like Britain has, I can't remember the latest statistics, but, you know, we just, like the other week, surpassed 100,000 deaths, you know, one of the highest death rates in Europe. So something's clearly gone very wrong with our public health system and like welfare systems and things. It's like focusing on growth clearly isn't the solution to that. Like, it's just perpetuating this inequality, like this wealth gap. So yeah, we wanted to find out more about the ethical principles and how like these can help us to recover from the pandemic. So Mel actually spoke to Dr. Sridhar Venkatapuram, who works at the Health Institute in King's College London.
Yeah, thanks so much for agreeing to talk with me. It's really, really kind of you.
Not at all. Thank you very much for inviting me. So as way of introduction, my name is Sridhar Venkatapuram, and I am an academic practitioner, as I call it, in ethics, public health ethics and global health ethics. And I sit at the King's Global Health Institute.
Nice. So what does ethical recovery from a pandemic mean to you at a conceptual level?
So I'll try to sort of answer it in a very easy way. I guess the way to do it is to contrast it with something that's not an ethical recovery. So think about a recovery that you find as being qualifies as being recovery, but you know, we would find it uncomfortable that there's something not right. So for example, it's a recovery where basically all older people have died because they've been thought to be sort of vulnerable, but had not taken care of because they thought that they're just old and they're not have much longer to live anyway. So we might as well not spend our resources on saving those people's lives. It would be a recovery that we would find satisfactory, for example, if you only vaccinated people that you decided were useful for economic recovery. Mm-hmm. And so you sort of identified those people that you decided were sort of the most important thing is to get the economy back. And therefore you identified those sectors or those people and basically gave them the vaccine or gave them special permissions or gave them special additional things while everybody else is sort of not. It would be not a very good recovery, for example, if you don't focus on children who've lost 1 year of develop, you know, children, some of the, you know, their first 2 years or their third and fourth year or whatever is very significant because they're constantly on a daily basis growing rapidly. Their brains are developing rapidly. And so if you, you know, basically kind of, you know, neglected them for a year or 2 years, or there's so many unequal things going on that if you just basically say, whatever, we'll just move on, whatever happened, we're just going to move on. That means that there's going to be things embedded into those children and that cohort and generation of people that you just sort of say, it doesn't matter, we're going to move on. So I guess what I'm trying to show you is there's different ways of recovery where you would say, gosh, that doesn't seem right. But I don't have a one big answer to you of like, if it satisfies X, Y, and Z, this would be an ethical recovery. I think what I would say is that, you know, we have to control the pandemic, not only locally, but globally, because of a variety of different reasons. And then we have to really think about, you know, what do we do about going forward? What do we do about correcting for the things that have happened before? What do we do about ensuring that this doesn't happen again? All of those things at the heart of it have some fundamental questions about, you know, what's the point of government? What's the point of us? What's the point of health? What's the point, you know, how important is health in relation to other things? So all of those things, I think, need to be sort of at the forefront of our conversations and our minds.
Yeah, certainly. It's obviously a complex issue. It's hard to move forward, but that's why I think I found reading about your work so inspiring, because it was re-centering everyone at the core of the recovery, not just, as you say, certain groups that might be considered useful, so to speak. You mentioned health, but why would you say it's important to consider health in relation to human rights or ethics? Why is it important to combine these disciplines and not just look at them in their own right?
You know, the really important thing is that, you know, what we saw in the AIDS pandemic and what we saw in Ebola and other kind of infectious outbreaks is that there's a lot of choices that policymakers and responders make about, one, whether to even do something about it or not. And I think that's a really important acknowledgement that, you know, not every country, not every government cares about the health of its people. And so it doesn't necessarily do anything. Or if it suddenly realizes that it's only affecting certain kinds of people, it doesn't really care. And it just sort of keeps going on. And so this was one of the issues with the HIV/AIDS pandemic, was that, you know, people thought, oh, these are just sort of, you know, homosexuals or injection drug users or prostitutes. You know, why do we care? We don't need to divert our public attention to those people's, you know, poor behaviors. And so millions and millions of people died as a result of that kind of thinking. So what that sort of brings to the forefront is this idea of neglect and duties and obligations and citizens' rights and human beings and what sort of rights do they have. So that's why I think is the why health and human rights and ethics have to come together, is because it's not just about, oh, we don't know how to make this difficult choice between do I save this person or that person. There's fundamental questions around, you know, when people are dying, what kind of rights do they have? The second question, I think, is a bit more complicated about why should we have ethics and human rights together. So if you think about human rights, a lot of people either go to human rights law. They sort of, in the European context, we go to the European court and sort of say, what did the human rights charter say? Or in the UK, we sort of use human rights in a very legalistic sense. Or some people also look at human rights in an international law sense. They sort of say, oh, well, the UN covenant. And I think there's some really important value to sort of saying we as people have made some things as being so important that we put them into law and we seek to enforce them in different kinds of ways. But the thing about ethics is that before you get them into the law, you have to have an argument as to why something is important and important enough to get them into the law. So in a way, ethics should, you know, precede the legal instrument. And some people might disagree with this enormously, but I'm sort of the view that when we want to make sense of competing laws, competing rights, if you want to think about something that has been ignored, that should be part of it, then you start with sort of ethical arguments about why it's the right thing, the coherent thing. So this is the reason why ethics and human rights have to come together, is that it's not just about taking a legal approach to human rights, but also thinking about, you know, what's the point of human rights law in the first place? And how do we sort of think about the conflicts and the gaps? And how do we think about the future? And how do we think about perhaps correcting the course of human rights if need be, et cetera? So for all those reasons, ethics and human rights have to come, you know, joined, have to come together.
I was just thinking of what you said about how ethics could precede human rights law. And I would largely agree. But also, would you say that ethics can help guide human rights law, like bring it back into what it's actually the core fundamental values are that it's being based on. These rights, they might exist in law, whether it's internationally or nationally, but if we don't understand what their parameters are and exactly what they mean, then how on earth are we going to know how to enforce
them? Yeah. This is a really big conversation about law and social change. I think the United States, where I grew up for many years, is a very excellent example of it, is that, you know, a lot of people think about going to the Supreme Court as a way of making social change. So a lot of people, I think since the 1960s, have sort of, you know, have, you know, in a variety of different ways, try to get the law changed or get the law struck down or get the law stuff. And they think that if they can get the Supreme Court to acknowledge, say, for example, women's equality or gay and lesbian rights or racial, you know, desegregation, then somehow this will solve the problems. And what we've seen in the United States is that you can change the law, but you haven't changed the minds and beliefs and norms in society. And that will come out, and that will come out, and it's not going to go away. And I think this is a long-standing debate. But it's the last year has shown us that simply changing the law or putting in new rights isn't enough. What you actually have to do is make sure that there's social, you know, acceptance of different kinds of things as well.
Yeah. Just going back to the HIV and AIDS epidemic, because I saw that you were the first researcher at Human Rights Watch to make the epidemic a human rights concern in the 90s. Would you say that there was anything that you learned or that you feel that the world learned from this epidemic and that could perhaps guide us in recovering from the present coronavirus pandemic, even in terms of like defining the right to health or something?
Yeah, so that's a really excellent question. I've been thinking about that a lot in the last few days, especially because for some reason people are suddenly talking about that. And it's taken a year or some for people to raise this kind of question. And I find that in itself interesting. I think one of the reasons that it's come up about the AIDS epidemic is that people are making statements like, oh my God, this is the greatest public health crisis in 100 years, as if the HIV/AIDS pandemic never happened. Right. So they're like, oh, the influenza epidemic. And so this sort of is the, and it's just like, well, where were you during the AIDS epidemic? You know, where were you sort of while 30 million people have died and all this stuff? So I think that there's sort of this concern that people are not actually looking at what's been happening over the last 2 decades or what happened during the AIDS epidemic and somehow just glossing over it and going all the way 100 years to influenza because that was sort of somehow a mass event or something like that. So your question is really, really important. And I think I could give you so many different answers. What we learned during the AIDS epidemic is one, that no matter how socially ostracized or marginalized or excluded that you may be, you still have certain kinds of rights for living and being protected from something that's dangerous to you and to care when you're sick, etc. So this idea that, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are, like, you know, whether you're rich or poor or gay or straight or man or woman, you know, drug user or not, that your health is something that is valuable to you and we have sort of obligations to help you and stuff. So that's one really important lesson, which I think we are not really focused on right now, is that we are all thinking about numbers in an aggregate level. It's like, oh, millions of vaccines and oh, millions of tests. It's like, well, actually, who is getting the vaccines and who is the homeless person getting a test and is the refugee getting the vaccine? Every person has, you know, a right to be healthy and to be protected from danger. The second thing, you know, that there's still no vaccine for HIV, right? Is that what we have is drugs that manage the condition. And so what we learned during that whole epidemic is that in the absence of a vaccine and treatment, what we have to do is change not only the individual's behavior, but the surrounding social conditions that make them vulnerable. And so, you know, the reason why there's, you know, women's equality movements and gender equality movements and gay rights is not just in them for the good for themselves, but also to improve the health of these people. So gender equality, or, you know, equality of women, improves the health of women from, you know, so they can access reproductive and sexual health services, so they can access, you know, legal sort of protections if they're being abused. And the same thing with gay rights as well. And what's so amazing to me is that in this COVID epidemic, so much of the focus has been on the science. Mm-hmm. Oh, if we can just get the pill or injection, rather than understanding that, you know, you have to change the social conditions that are making certain people vulnerable to this infection. And what are the things that we're going to do in order to transform those bad social norms and practices so that individuals are able to kind of be protected, protect themselves? So a lot of people just think, well, if you just give people vaccines, we don't have to deal with all of that. And I think that's a really short-term thinking, because there will be other pandemics. There will be more health crises. And if you actually change the norms and the social conditions, these people will be protected against all of them rather than just this one disease because they have a vaccine against it.
Yeah, you called it a monodimensional response. And that was really interesting because, yeah, it just means that all of the other factors that make up our society and like the disparities in health aren't considered. On that basis, how are you and your team at the King's Health Institute helping to keep the government in check or other institutions in check to ensure that they're keeping on track for an ethical response? And is there anything in particular that's making you either hopeful or concerned in that respect?
Yeah. So, I mean, this has been, you know, something that I've been trying to do since, you know, February of 2020, is how do we get ethics and equity involved in the response from the get-go rather than it being sort of a secondary concern to people? So, you know, a lot of people think that this is just simply, like I said, a kind of biological and public health sciencey problem. So if we can just get the people to change their behaviors, and if we can just get people a vaccine, then we're going to solve this problem. So, you know, what we've been doing is that I've been trying to motivate people who are ethicists to be involved in their, you know, in the different kinds of institutions that are making decisions. And I'm also sitting on the World Health Organization's, what they call the guideline development group for clinically managing COVID. So I don't know if you know about this, but basically when you go to your doctor and say, for example, you have COVID, the doctor has to know how to treat it. And so they, you know, how will they magically suddenly know that they're going to have to do this, this, and this to treat COVID? And what they do is that they look up different kinds of guidance for, okay, if your patient has this thing, then this is what you should do. So there's different kinds of sources. So in some countries, so for example, in the UK, you might have something called NICE, which is the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, where doctors will look up sort of instructions and guidance for how to treat certain kinds of things. And so in the world, what happens is the WHO provides that kind of guidance. It's sort of the state of the art guidance for if you get a patient with COVID, this is how you should treat them. And then also, you know, when all these people are basically saying, oh, you know what, this works for treating COVID or that works for treating COVID. And so this group essentially has been reviewing the evidence to see whether different kinds of treatments are actually working, or they're just sort of hearsay and rumor, and doctors are just sort of relying on secondhand information saying, oh, I heard that this works, so let's just give it and see what happens kind of stuff. So, and I sit on that as an ethicist, not as a scientist. I have a background in sort of medicine and public health, but my main concern is more about the ethical aspects of that. So yeah, lots of different ways in which we're trying to raise the idea of ethics and equity and justice in the response.
And more long-term then, obviously a lot of what you're saying is based on a much more equitable and looking at the root causes of social problems as a means of, as being part of the reason we've got ourselves in the pandemic and that it's been so catastrophic. But do you think it's possible that we can actually restore community and human rights at in our system, and not just for the recovery of the pandemic, but for the future of UK government and global policies? Yeah.
You know, this is the million-dollar question. I don't think it's I think it's a really important moment, and this is the really thing that, to go back to the AIDS epidemic, is that you can sit and wait for the answer to come out, or you can be part of the effort to see which way the answer comes out. And I think that I'm not the kind of person that kind of waits and sort of say, well, will it turn out well or will it not turn out well? I think part of our job is to try to see that it does turn out well. And how can we do that? And what are we capable of as individuals? And what are we capable of as collective action that we know of and that we can do? And this conversation, for example, is a contribution to that, right? Like you basically, like this is my contribution towards making sure that we have a better recovery and response. And so in a similar way, so I don't know. I think that, this is when I get really philosophical and sort of think about it as long-term, you know, things, as Martin Luther King said, bend towards justice, right? So The things might be horrible this week, this month, this year. But I think over time, things will get like bend towards more equity and justice. But I also would like to think that, you know, for example, in the United Kingdom, in England especially, people have woken up to new realities, that they've been shaken out of this sense that you don't just wait passively and let others decide what policies are. Actually, when you're desperate for good policies and you realize how bad they are, you realize you need to make better choices about who you put into office for policymakers, and you need to be paying more attention to getting involved in the policymaking process itself. And all those kinds of things. I'm optimistic that people have been shaken out of like being passive citizens and rather are going to be a bit much more active. And especially young people, I think, have to realize that their entire future is in the hands of certain people. And if they don't get actively engaged, they're just going to be, at the mercy of all these other people who have very short-term agendas, and they really need to be thinking about the long-term.
For sure. And with that in mind, is there one thing that you would say that on a personal level you do that you would recommend to people, whatever age, or whether you think it would be directed at a certain age group, but what could I or others do in their day-to-day life that can help us restore this ethical response to the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. I think for me, over the last year and some months, one of the most important things has been the recognition that we as individuals cannot expect to do something impactful if we're not sort of solid and stable ourselves as individuals. So what I mean by that is that we have to, as individuals, be able to have a good sense of self-mastery. Like we can look at things when things are not going well and we are okay. And when we look at things and things are going well, we're still okay. Like it's this idea of self-mastery. And that means are you taking care of your health? Are you also taking care of your mind? Are you sort of able to deal with shocks? And are you able to be, are you engaging with other human beings in a sort of nice way? So I think that it's this idea. So the way that I've been sort of thinking about it, and the way that I sort of talk about people on Twitter, is this idea that this is a marathon, and we need to be able to get into the mindset of someone who runs marathons, right? Is that some days are good, some days are bad, but we just keep going. The important thing is that every day we just keep going, and the aim is not the short run. It's the idea of sustaining our effort for a long time. And the second most really important thing is collective action, is that we won't be able to do this as an individual, and we need to be able to do this together as newts. So what are the different ways that we can join up with others who are interested in making the world better, interested in correcting things that have gone wrong, interested in, this idea of equity and making sure that everybody has sort of a place at the table. And there's lots of those kinds of people, I think, and, sort of just significantly much more people now understand the importance, the link between health and justice, and that health isn't just in the clinic. Health is like what happens outside and how do you relate to other people and what happens inside the home. And so how do we make sure that everybody is able to get access to health? And so how are we going to make sure that that becomes more important in the future?
Well, I hope that this conversation and conversations going forward with others can help to inspire that sort of self-mastery, as you say, and yeah, compassion amongst people, no matter how small the space, it can filter out into much bigger things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much, though.
For talking. Absolutely. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for reaching out.
We've seen the importance of community, whether that's like us like missing our like interaction, social interaction with our friends and family, or just kind of seeing how communities like come together in times of need, with communities helping one another, you know, people offering to do food shops for elderly neighbours. Or I think that's like, again, another key message that we kind of want to highlight, and is what we focused last week's episode on the environmental side of things on. Is that okay? Like, the structure of our society may need a lot of work, but we can come together as communities and like through grassroots organizations and small scale projects and work together. And like, that shouldn't be lost. And like, we should hold on to that.
And like, yeah, just thinking of that sort of thing, I think it would be good to give people, restore this sense of hope and like remind people of this sense of community. Should we talk about a few of the lessons on how we can, get on with this ethical recovery?
Yeah. So I think like, firstly, is that an ethical recovery means not putting money or institutions at the centre. It means putting people, particularly vulnerable people, at the centre of our response. In the conversations you have with people, or when you're reading the news, just spend a bit of time thinking about the message behind it. Like, is that message one that is compassionate and puts people at the forefront? Does it consider people's welfare and well-being as the central element? Does it consider and treat people as equal, or does it devalue someone for their contribution?
One classic COVID message that we can think about in this way is Boris's stay at home, protect the NHS, save lives. And just thinking about this message, like in comparison to other countries, Switzerland's catchphrase for COVID was, this affects us all. Italy said, everything will be all right. India said, prepare, don't panic. And my favorite, Argentina said, thanks from my heart. And this was to address the healthcare workers. So like, Boris's message saying, stay at home, protect the NHS and save lives, seems quite ridiculous when you really pick it apart, and like when you really consider these sorts of like, how has the compassion been shown? Because actually it's not paying any due diligence or expressing any concern towards the people who are working for the NHS, or the NHS workers and staff and volunteers. It's just saying protect the NHS, which is an institution. And the Guardian reported this like as a like huge hypocrisy, because the government has actually spent the last 10 years not protecting the NHS and has completely villainized it in the media, and like it has neglected it in as an institution in itself. It's sold off parts of the NHS. And we, like, before COVID, we were already short of 43,000 nurses. So it does seem kind of crazy that Boris's message had no, not really any, what's the word? Wasn't actually considering the people who make up the NHS and like how it runs so effectively. It just, It suggested that its like most precious asset was...
Yeah, it's very insular and individualistic. And I was actually reading something recently. It was published by King's College London, that basically said that countries that have a more individualistic society have actually fared significantly worse than collective ones in coping with COVID-19?
Yeah, there's the sort of level sense of compassion that is provided, like that is being sent out. And given that our government is sort of a bedrock for our society, like if even our prime minister isn't sending out that message of strong unity, what's that going to do for all of the individuals that we are? We're not going to be so have those feelings of togetherness in quite the same way.
Yeah, and I think this all kind of links back to the importance of our language choices. And I actually find that so fascinating, comparing the different countries' kind of slogans for COVID, because I mean, I never really thought deeper about Boris's slogan. But yeah, like it just shows the importance of language. And I recently wrote a blog post looking at the importance of language when talking about refugees, and just to kind of link to that, because I think it just sort of is all part of the same conversation of the importance of our language choices.
Yeah, totally. And from my point of view, like his choice of language could show appreciation for the gravity of the problem, and like linking back to what we were saying at the beginning, like an acknowledgement and an honest acknowledgement for the fragilities of our system. So I don't know, when I was reading the recovery plan that the government put out, it was saying like, oh, we need to go back to normal as quickly as possible. And I get that the government wants to send out that sort of message of hope. But is normal really what we want to go back to? Is like normal really going to be that good for a lot of people? Like we've just discussed all of the things that COVID has exacerbated. So maybe better to acknowledge that normal simply wasn't good enough, and state that they're going to do something to improve on the structural deficiencies of our system.
No, exactly. And like that's, I guess, the point of the whole podcast is like us just sort of saying that we don't just need to go back to business as usual. We need to refocus and have an ethical recovery.
Like at an individual level, not being individualistic, sounds kind of funny, but for each of us, making sure that the ethical recovery does happen, the action that we can take is confined to small community-based spaces. Yes, like in our homes with our friends and relatives, and we all need to be engaged in the process of meaning making and community building and basically serving an ethical purpose in ourselves to reaffirm the true value of justice in our society and the way of building and fulfilling a meaningful productive life for ourselves and each other.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think that puts it perfectly. Like it's just about rethinking how things work, and like we've got to this pandemic crisis, but you know, we need to like think of the positives and think of the ways we can use this to like change, to become better. And even if the global political situation might seem bleak, like we kind of hope with this podcast that we can show like the things you can do on a smaller scale. And although that might seem minor, if we all make changes, you know, like as we quoted last week by Margaret Mead, the anthropologist and American author, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has.
If you are interested or concerned by any of the issues raised during this podcast, then please get in touch at contact@earthrights.co.uk or visit our website www.earthrights.co.uk. You can find full recordings of all of the episodes on most podcast platforms or on the Earth Rights website, referenced in the show notes. We host a blog on there too, as well as recommendations and other information. Please also join in on the journey by following our Twitter and Instagram accounts @earthrights_.
If you would like to be involved in an episode of the Earth Rights podcast, then please also get in touch. This Earth Rights podcast was hosted, produced, and edited by us. Music and sounds were specially made for Earth Rights by the Mowgli Wild Boys, who are currently recording a new LP at Circuit Studios in Nottingham. Please follow their Instagram and Facebook @Mowgli Wild Boys.